Hello, this is Ron Falk for the Department of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, and welcome to the Chair's Corner. Today we welcome Dr. Ethan Bash, who's professor of medicine in our Division of Hematology and Oncology. He holds also an appointment as professor of health policy and management in the School of Public Health. Dr. Bash, amongst a number of wonderful things that he does, is the director of the UNC Cancer Center Outcomes Research Program. He serves as an associate editor of one of the American most prestigious journals, the Journal of the American Medical Association, otherwise known as JAMA, and has numerous other leadership roles on national committees and programs, which I hope we'll get to discuss later in our program. So, Ethan Bash, welcome.
Thanks. Very nice to be here.
You are a cancer doc. You are an oncologist, and you take care of people with cancer, specifically prostate cancer. But what you've really made your name in, your notoriety, if we could say, is in this whole sphere of patient-reported outcome measures. What on earth is a patient-reported outcome, and why do I even want to know about that?
Sure. Well, thanks, and thank you for the nice introduction. It's a great question. A patient-reported outcome simply is something that a patient tells to either a healthcare provider or a researcher about how they're feeling or functioning, essentially a symptom or how they're physically functioning. And that's generally done through simple questionnaires. Now, this sounds like a very simple concept. We all fill out surveys and questionnaires all the time. We get them in the mail, we get them by telephone, we get them by computer. But in fact, in healthcare, historically, unfortunately, we have not done a very good job getting information from our patients about how they're feeling or functioning. For example, a patient may come to see me in the office. I might meet with them for 20 or 30 minutes. And then until I see them the next time, they spend more than 99% of their time out of sight and out of mind. And we don't have really effective mechanisms for being in touch with our patients and knowing how they're doing. Now, certainly a patient can pick up the telephone and call us. Sometimes our electronic health record systems have a portal. But we know that most people don't take advantage of this. In fact, I saw a patient just yesterday in clinic who received chemotherapy and felt terribly, was in bed much of the time, had a lot of symptoms, and came back to see me 3 weeks later. And I said to my patient, and his wife was there with him, I said, you know, why didn't you call? You know, it's my job. I'd like to know. I could have helped. And he said, well, I didn't want to bother you. And I think, unfortunately, this is often the situation, that either it's too cumbersome or challenging or there's some sort of block to communicating with us. And frankly, it's not easy to communicate with us. And so these very simple tools, electronic questionnaires that allow patients to tell us how they're doing, have actually had a remarkable impact on our ability to communicate with patients, to control symptoms, to reduce emergency room visits and hospitalizations. And in fact, in oncology, it turns out that people live longer when they are given simple questionnaires between visits to communicate with their doctors.
Because there is this sense that patients disappear, that everything must be okay because you haven't heard from them, and thus all is okay. But in reality, in a lot of conditions, not just in cancer, those assumptions are not valid. UNC and many other institutions have tried to have that dialogue with, UNC has, with Epic, something called My Chart, My UNC Chart. Why doesn't that work? Or does it work to a certain extent, or does it really only work in certain populations?
Yeah, it does work to a certain extent. So My Chart is essentially a patient-facing part of the electronic health record system. So we all, as physicians and nurses, use an electronic health record system to keep track of information about patients. And there's a component of that that allows patients to see their own laboratory reports, to make appointments, and to send messages. And these systems do have some rudimentary questionnaire functions, but they really are very rudimentary. And we know that, unfortunately, the vast minority of patients actually sign up for these what are called patient portals. I think we're at the beginning. I think they're getting better, and they will become easier for patients. It will be important to meet patients where they live. For example, if I want to do a transaction for my bank account, I can do it through my phone, through the web, over the telephone. So we need that kind of flexibility to meet people where they live and how they live their lives. The research that I'm engaged with is essentially informing how patient portals like MyChart should work in the future so that we can reach more people and be more effective.
Especially in this era where everybody is on some sort of social media, even folks of my generation text and email, some Facebook. But it doesn't work as well with the medical profession. There is that translation of those tools to patient care seems to have lagged. Why?
Yeah.
It's a big industry. Why the lag?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, you know, I think one important point from your statement is that people exchange information about how they're feeling all the time. They exchange information about the side effects from their medications. They exchange information about the symptoms of, you know, of their disease. And we miss that. We are not capturing that. It's a major loss because we could use that information to understand the effectiveness of drugs and other treatments. We could use that to help manage patients. We could use that information to understand quality of care. So it's a major missed opportunity. I think it's because in many ways, this aspect of medicine, like many aspects of medicine, don't start with the patient in mind. They start with the provider and the institution in mind. You know, we have built hospitals to the convenience of physicians, right? I have a schedule for my clinic, and patients must fit into my schedule. If patients want to reach me, they must call my office. And so we're not patient-centered.
Yeah, so the airline industry has completely revamped that. You can not only get a reservation online, you can pick your seat online. You can't do that in all places in the healthcare center. That's what you're suggesting, that a patient should, if they want to come to see you, have some sort of ease in getting an appointment, but even more importantly, an ease in actually being able to interact with you. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, I think that's right. And, for example, the ATM is a nice example of this. You know, I remember as a child my father lining up on Friday at the bank, that was a great inconvenience and at the convenience of the bank. And, a simple change like an automatic teller and interoperability between banks really changed this dramatically. And I think we're seeing this more and more in healthcare. We're becoming more patient-centered. We're thinking about the patient's home context and how they live their lives and real-time and non-real-time means of communication. But we're really not there yet. And so, unfortunately, as we sit here today, you know, we both have patients who are out of sight and out of mind and may, in fact, be suffering. And that may have very substantial downstream consequences.
So for a patient, the ability to interact on their terms would be tremendously beneficial. It'd be also beneficial if there were some rudimentary kinds of measures that you could get in the home. You're working on some of those measures right now. One can imagine weight and blood pressure are physical characteristics that one could ask for. But your questionnaires are trying to, in a structured fashion, probe how the patient is feeling. Am I getting that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. So I run a research program that has been investigating this area for about 15 years now. We've developed multiple questionnaire systems, several for national organizations like the National Cancer Institute or the Maine Oncology Professional Society. We've developed technology platforms, but most of all, we have explored the different kinds of workflows, the ways to integrate these into people's lives, patients' lives, and the ways to integrate these into busy clinicians' lives. And we found a number of things. In the early research, we found that clinicians miss about half of the symptoms that their patients have. Simply
just
miss
half?
Them. Yeah, I know. Well, so for some things, it's more, yeah. Well, your statement is telling. You know, I think we as clinicians actually recognize this. We know this is a problem. Much of the early work that I was involved with was actually around clinical research, really drug development in oncology. And that was because when we develop new drugs in oncology, they are often very toxic. They have a lot of serious side effects. And because of this phenomenon that we've been talking about, the missing of people's symptoms and missing their functional problems, when we have developed drugs, we have had these huge underestimates of the negative impact on people, so that when regulatory authorities like the FDA look at the profiles of these drugs or, say, devices that are coming through, we underestimate really the toxicities or the adverse events related to them. And so much of our work has actually been to improve drug development to get a better understanding of the patient experience. More recently, we've turned our attention to delivery of care and figuring out how to integrate this into how we take care of people every day.
So what have you found out? What works and what doesn't work as well?
Yeah. So a few things work. So the first challenge is engaging people to understand that this is important, this is worth their time, and that this information will be used. We've found that generally people will be enthusiastic to provide this information if they know that their doctor or their nurse want the information, and that they'll use the information. If they find that nobody is paying any attention to this, they quickly lose interest. And in fact, that's annoying. You know, I personally would be annoyed by that as well. But in general, when we have spoken to patients, and we've spoken to many, many patients from all different kinds of backgrounds, we have found that people are very enthusiastic. Now, for the most part, these are people who have chronic conditions. They have heart failure or, you know, pulmonary diseases or cancer. So they're people who have ongoing problems, ongoing symptoms. This really doesn't apply as much to people who are, you know, well and see the doctor once a year. So it's people who are already very engaged with the healthcare system and understand that their symptoms are important. We have found that in clinical research, about 95% of the time people will provide this information. In clinical practice, more like 85%. But most notably, what we found is that in clinical trials, when we collect this information from patients, we greatly enhance the data that we have. We improve the precision of the data that we have. And the clinical investigators consistently feedback, those are the people doing the research, that this information has actually changed their decision-making about how the drug is given, how it's dosed, and how to recommend the use of the drug. And it's changed drug labels, the actual way that the FDA is labeling the drugs. In routine care, what we found is that, again, patients are enthusiastic about this. Clinicians use and are also very positive about the information. And as I alluded to earlier, when we integrate these patient-reported questionnaires into clinical practice, symptom management improves, patients' quality of life improves, communication with providers improves, patient satisfaction improves, emergency room visits significantly go down, and in the case of people with advanced cancers, they actually live longer because their symptoms are better controlled.
So how do you, as a practicing physician, have the time to be able to read or assimilate in one way or the other all of this information? How do you make it so that on days when you're not actually seeing that patient, you have the opportunity to have captured time to listen to these very important thoughts?
It's a great question, because there are many potential criticisms or many criticisms or comments one can receive around this, but one of them is, doctors and nurses are already so busy. How can you burden them further with more information? There will be an onslaught of information. It will be overwhelming. And I think I have a couple of answers to that. So the first is that, again, I come back to this patient-centered piece that, you know, an orientation or a filter by which we say, well, we can't overburden our doctors and nurses with this information, is a very doctor-nurse-centered way of thinking. It's not patient-centered, because our patients are at home with symptoms, and it's our job to manage those symptoms. The second answer is that this is already part of what we do, right? Symptom management is a major part of my job as an oncologist. And then the third part is that the research that we have done has actually demonstrated that this is not a major burden. There's actually not a lot of added time for doing this. In fact, it ultimately saves time, because we avoid bad downstream consequences that we've avoided by catching symptoms earlier.
You specialize in prostate cancer. How have you applied the things you've learned to caring for older males with prostate disease, prostate cancer in particular?
So in my own practice, I've applied some of these principles in a number of ways. The first is that we have actually used some of these tools that we've been talking about in these populations to have a better handle on how people are feeling between visits. That's been very effective for communication, so that when a patient comes into the clinic and sees one of us, rather than starting at the beginning and screening and talking about all their symptoms, we can say, oh, you know, Mr. Smith, I see here from your form that since I saw you last, you've been having worsening pain and worsening nausea. I also see that you've been trying the following measures for it. You know, tell me, how's that going? And that jumps us far ahead and makes our encounter more efficient. A second way is that I think myself as a provider, I've really tried to focus more on how people are feeling, realizing that we miss so much of how people are feeling. So I really try to engage. A third way is that I work very closely with a nurse navigator. And there's a lot of interest nationally in nurses who focus on how people are doing at home. And the nurse navigator I work with has very close interaction with the patients in my practice, both at and between visits, to make sure that we understand, that they understand the various components of their treatment and that we understand how they're doing.
Translating it, in other words. Translating what you've said, or just another set of ears to listen to what the patient's trying to say?
Well, I think it's both. You know, for example, sometimes results of tests are mailed to patients at home, and those results are in my language, not in their language. It's often very difficult to decipher the meaning of that, and simply having somebody available to talk to patients about that can be very useful. But to your point, there's a translation about how the patients are experiencing their home life to us in the clinic, where we wouldn't otherwise be aware of that.
In the prostate cancer world, as in many aspects of medicine, there can be a divergence between you've been cured of your disease, but your health has not been restored. In other words, the cancer is gone, but either therapy or psychological adaptation have not been as effective, and the patient's health is not back to where it was before the cancer chemotherapy or radiation therapy was initiated. What have you learned to help us understand how patients perceive, I've been cured of my prostate cancer, but because of the therapy, I no longer can have sex? How does your research help with that problem?
Yeah, it's that is a real challenge in not just in oncology, but in other contexts. But in oncology, there are many patients either who are cured or who are living with their cancer for a very long period of time, who have many sequelae, many consequences of their treatment. In the case of prostate cancer, following surgery or radiation, men may be left with urinary problems and with sexual function problems for their whole life, as well as fear of recurrence and other psychosocial challenges. One of the benefits of the kind of research I'm describing is simply to understand problems that exist among many men and to acknowledge them. For years in prostate cancer, we didn't acknowledge this. We sort of, you know, brushed it under the carpet. And this was a problem for a couple of reasons. One, because men who were living with this weren't acknowledged and they sort of suffered in silence. And as a result, it wasn't talked about and people couldn't seek help or counseling, or there actually are medical interventions to help people, for example, with erectile problems. But the second reason is that we were not able to adequately prepare men undergoing these procedures for what they might expect. We weren't able to say, you know, for the kind of disease you have and the kind of procedure you're going to have, men like you experienced moderate urinary problems, you know, about a third of the time, by which I mean they had some dribbling and some staining of their underwear or some incontinence when coughing, et cetera. So this kind of research just makes us more aware so that we can communicate with patients and try to address their problems better.
Men have difficulty sometimes being able to be in touch with their emotions, let alone able to express them. So do these questionnaires, do the ability to self-report permit men to be more honest about these feelings and thus communicate them to you rather than to respond to a direct question that you may ask?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. In fact, there is research demonstrating that particularly when it comes to delicate topics like sexual function, people, men and women both, are far more likely to report this information to a questionnaire than they will to a human, including their doctor or a nurse. So this actually enables us to unroof problems that we wouldn't otherwise know about.
Do you provide these questionnaires to the patient? And at what point do you provide questionnaires to a significant other who may be accompanying the patient on the visit?
There are all different ways that this is done in various contexts. For the most part, the questionnaire does go to the patient. However, we know from much of the research that we and others have done that oftentimes the patient also brings a team. And, you know, we know from observing people answering questions in the questionnaire that, you know, say a man in my practice would be answering and his wife or his, you know, child would be elbowing them saying, come on, you know, come on, dad, that's not really how it is. And so there's a lot of input, you know, to these. In general, we haven't really handed out questionnaires to caregivers on a routine basis, but it's probably a conversation for another day, but the truth is that caregivers go through an incredibly challenging experience when there's a patient with a chronic illness. And being more in touch with the caregivers, as they say, providing care to the caregiver, is really probably essential. And we could probably achieve that through questionnaires, and it's a great idea for future research.
Tell me what the questions are that men most typically ask you, men with prostate cancer. What are the top five questions that are asked?
Yeah. So I'm an oncologist, so I often see men who unfortunately have a cancer that has come back or can't be cured. And so men want to know things like what kind of symptoms can I expect to have? How long can I expect to live? People want to know about the side effects of the medications. They want to understand what they'll still be able to do. What will their strength be like? Can they continue their activities? And people also want to know if they need to make any behavioral modifications. Do they need to change their diet or their exercise? Are there any herbs or supplements they could take? Those are the kinds of things that people generally ask about.
Yeah. Are there new and exciting therapeutic options for prostate cancer patients?
There are a number of very effective new therapies in, again, in the medical oncology field, which is among people who have advanced cancers, that have come into use very recently. And these are advanced hormonal types of therapies. One is called abiraterone acetate, another is called enzalutamide. What's exciting about these medicines is first that they're pills, they're not intravenous. People can take them at home. And the second very exciting component of them is that they have very few side effects, which we know because we have administered patient-reported outcome questionnaires to people to understand that people can live their lives without a lot of toxicities, which is pretty different from the traditional chemotherapies that we had, which caused quite a bit of toxicity. So this is very exciting. There are also exciting new radiotherapy types of approaches in which we give these very small molecules to people that emit tiny bursts of radiation called alpha particles right at the site where the cancer is when it goes to the bone. And there's one called radium-223 that's very exciting. Immunotherapies have been very interesting across oncology in general, but unfortunately have not seemed to have the same kind of effectiveness in prostate cancer that we've seen in other cancers.
Fascinating. Thank you once again for spending time with me today. Thanks so much for all you do.
Oh, thank you very much, and likewise.